Hey, howdy everybody, and thanks for joining us here again on Expanded Perspectives with me, Cam Hale, and joining me, of course, as always, is the maestro over here, Mr. Kyle Filson.
How's it going, everybody?
Hope y'all had a wonderful, wonderful week and weekend. For everybody that follows us on Instagram and all you elitists, everybody, they already knew this was going to happen, and for everybody else, if you're into ancient history as much as we are, you're going to enjoy what we're doing today.
Especially ancient Egypt.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. This one was a fun one, folks. Everybody knows that we're junkies for it. Me and Kyle, we had to get our fix. We had an amazing time and got lucky and got to interview Mr. Scott Crichton. And we are going to be discussing his book, The Secret Chamber of Osiris. Now, I always love the under parts here. Lost Knowledge of the 16 Pyramids. And it was awesome. We had a great time chatting with him. For those of you that don't know, now, Scott is an engineer by trade. He's traveled all over the world, basically, and he's gone to tons of the ancient sites. And he's actually the host of the Alternative Egyptology Forum there on AboveTopSecret.com. And he's co-authored the book, The Giza Prophecy. He has put a lot of work into this, and I don't want to give away too much, but I will say this. You know, there's for the last, I don't know, couple hundred years, it's always been thought of as a tomb. The Great Pyramid and all the pyramids have always been thought of as tombs. Well, he's kind of brought it around to where it's really not. And of course, most all of us that are alternative historians know it's not. So he has a really interesting take on it, and it's one of those ones that I think he's right. I think there's a lot that goes into what he says is right, especially in the book and interview. But anyway, enough beating around the bush, folks. I think you're really going to enjoy this. We had a wonderful time talking to him. And let's go ahead and jump right into this interview, folks. Thank you so much for being here today. We hope we can broaden your minds and expand your perspectives. And all right, let's jump right into it. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. All right, folks, and with us today is a special guest, Mr. Scott Crichton. He's wrote this fantastic book called The Secret Chamber of Osiris. He's an engineer. He's been all over the world looking at a lot of these sacred sites, and he's got some interesting stories he's going to share with us today. Scott, how are you doing?
I'm good. I'm good, guys. How are you doing?
We're doing well. It's raining a lot, but besides that, we're doing okay. How's everything in Scotland?
It's a bit wet, a bit dreish, as we say here in Scotland, but I'm sure it'll clear up in the next few days. This is the longest day of the year, of course, so it may be raining a bit longer than usual.
Man, that sounds good. Well, I love the book, and it's one of my favorite subjects that you get into in the book about Egypt and the pyramids, you know, and, you know, one of my favorite things, one of the new things that I had never heard of before, and you brought it out in this book that I was super excited about, is the fact that two of the great pyramids, the pyramid of Menkaure and Khufu, are actually eight-sided pyramids, not the traditional four, that there's that line that goes through there. And you know what? I've never heard of anyone talk about that. You outline it in some of the photographs in the book. Can you tell everybody about the significance of those two pyramids and the fact that they're actually eight-sided?
Yeah. Okay, well, guys, this was really a puzzle for me. I discovered that myself, about 10 years ago now, something like that. And it was a puzzle, and I myself wondered why the ancient builders had made life so much more complicated for themselves by constructing the Great Pyramid, that's the Pyramid of Khufu, and the smallest of the three giant pyramids at Giza, that's G3, the Pyramid of Menkaure. You know, just why would they make life so much more difficult? Why not just, you see, these pyramids, the sides of these pyramids are very, very slightly indented towards the centre on each of the four sides. So basically, you have an eight-sided pyramid, G1 and G3. And it was a real puzzle. You know, it just makes no sense because the second pyramid at Giza, the pyramid of Khafre that Egyptologists call G2. That pyramid is perfect. Each side is perfectly straight. There's no slight indentation towards the centre of each face of that pyramid. So why not that one? And why did they do that with the other two? And this was a puzzle that, you know, my brain ticked over and mulled over and thought about for years, really. And, you know, it was the answer to that, or what I think is the answer to that. It's certainly a possible answer to why they did that. Is it's all to do with it's to do with geometry. It's to do with using the pyramids themselves to point to a specific location quite close to Giza, where I believe there is a hidden chamber, what I call the secret chamber of Osiris. So that's what I think those indentations are. We call them concavities, and it's basically a central line that goes up each of the elevations of each of those two pyramids. And Egyptologists just don't know why the ancient Egyptians did that. So I present a theory in the book that explains those particular features and how they are used to actually point to a specific location just to the southwest of the Giza Plateau.
And I guess I love the fact also, too, and the listeners need to know this, too. When you started the book off, Scott, I love it. There's a quote that you have in there at the very beginning of the first chapter of Daniel Bornstein, and it's probably one of my favorite quotes. And for those of you that don't know who Daniel was, he was the librarian of the U.S. Congress and a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian. But the quote is, "The greatest obstacle to discovery is not ignorance. It is the illusion of knowledge." And it holds true to this book because people are so set in their ways of the way we look at Egypt and the way that what we are kind of got this veil pulled over our eyes by Egyptologists from the past of what we believe is the true story there. And you've done the work of just what you've just discussed and so much more, showing that there's more to it. And we've talked to a bunch of these people. There's something that you brought up in the book that I was totally unaware of. And when I read it, I was like, whoa, it's the first 11, the layout, let's say, of the first 11 pyramids of what they actually outline. Can you tell the listeners about that?
Yeah. Basically, what I've tried to do is interpret not just the Great Pyramid, as a lot of these books and alternative history attempt to do, is just explain the Great Pyramid. I've tried to explain all the early pyramids of ancient Egypt. Now, when I say early pyramids, what I'm talking about here is there's a demarcation line. There are two distinct phases of pyramid building in ancient Egypt. There's what I call the very ancient period, and then we have the dynastic period of the ancient Egyptians. Now, the very ancient period is when the giant pyramids were built. These are like the first, what I call the first 16 pyramids of Egypt. That's the giant pyramids plus the small satellite pyramids at Giza. In total, they built about 19 of those pyramids, but there's three of them that were never completed, so we're down to about 16. Now, the thing is, the ancient Egyptian pyramid texts, these are the most ancient religious writings that we have from anywhere in the world. And they tell us a couple of things. They tell us that the pyramid is Osiris. The construction is Osiris. It says it as clear as day, as plain as day, the pyramid is Osiris. It also says something rather curious. It says the pyramid is the grain. And we know that the god Osiris, he was one of the most revered gods in ancient Egypt. He was associated with rebirth and with agriculture. Now, the myth of Osiris, tells us that his body was cut into 16 parts by his brother Seth. And then a switch went on in my head one day. I thought, well, if the pyramid texts are telling us that the pyramid is Osiris, and the myth of Osiris tells us that Osiris' body was cut into 16 parts, does that mean that there are 16 pyramids or 16 pieces of Osiris scattered across the land of Egypt, as the myth of Osiris tells us? So what I did then was I took my faithful Google Earth, and I got a map of Egypt, and I plotted the first 16 pyramids. That includes the small satellite pyramids at Giza. And essentially you have 11 of these giant pyramids. And when you plot those onto this map and then you join the lines, what you end up with is on the ground is a drawing of what is essentially the classic effigy or the classic figurine of Osiris that we see in all the ancient Egyptian drawings. You know, Osiris usually standing with his arms crossed, with the crook and flail in each hand, with the distinctive three-pronged Atif crown. You have a representation of that figure on the ground at Giza. You know, so I'm thinking, well, maybe that is essentially where the myth of Osiris stems from. It stems from the fact that the pyramid literally is Osiris, and it is his body on the ground in 16 pieces scattered across the west bank of the Nile, just as the ancient Plutarch's myth of Osiris tells us. So that was, you know, I never expected to find that when I looked at these first pyramids, but there it was, and in context of the mythology of what we are told that's been passed down to us, it makes perfect sense of the mythology and of the ancient pyramid texts that have been passed down to us, that the pyramid is Osiris, and that Osiris is the grain, because this goes back to the reason why the very ancient builders constructed these first 16 pyramids in the form, or what would become the form or the body of Osiris on the west bank of the Nile.
And it's one of those, it was kind of hidden right in front of all of us this whole time. And you just, it just kind of dawned on you, like, wait a second. And I guess that was something else too, that there's a lot of it that you allude to in the books, and it's great as the way you talk about the way you kind of, it just dawned on you like an epiphany. All of a sudden you're like, oh, wait. And it's funny how sometimes when you distance yourself and take a little time away from subjects, they seem to find their kind of ooze back into you, and you start thinking about it. You're like, oh, okay, I got it. I guess one of them is centroid mathematics, is the way you looked at the layout now, is you kind of put all these pyramids under more of a microscope and then found something else.
Yeah. Well, you know, without, you know, going too deep into math or geometry, because it really isn't that, you know, deep at all. Centroid mathematics is very, very simple. And it started for me with, I was reading Joachim's, some of Joachim's work, and he related a tale about the Jedi, who was priest of Khufu, Khufu wanted to know where the secret chambers of Osiris were hidden, and he wanted the keys, and the Jedi told Khufu that it would be the keys would be found by three kings or three men or three kings. And this, you know, sort of resonated with me. It's sort of like, well, what does that mean? It's obviously some kind of hidden meaning there. And I thought, well, what if these three kings are actually the three pharaohs that are attributed to the three pyramids? In essence, what then? Perhaps the Jedi meant that, you know, the secret chamber would be found by the three pyramids. at Giza. And so that, for me, the answer, and I was trying to find a way, well, okay, if it's the three pyramids at Giza that are pointing somehow to this secret chamber, how could they actually do that? How could you take three objects that are spaced in a particular manner and get them to work in a unique way to point to a very specific unique location? And it took me months, years. And one day, my son, Jamie, he was working on a math project, and he just asked me very innocently, "Dad, how do you find the center of a triangle?" And it was just a question that simple. And I started to explain, well, unlike a circle, which has one center, unlike a square, which has one center, a rectangle has one center, a triangle can actually have thousands of different ways of plotting essentially a center. It doesn't have a single center. Now, in the ancient world, I think at the moment, in our current mathematical knowledge, we know something like there's over 5,000 different ways of plotting a different center within a triangle. But in the ancient world, they knew only of three of these different ways of plotting a center. And the thing about the centroid geometry is that it ties in with the concavities of G1 and G3, which the centroid geometry. And using the concavities and the centroid geometry, we can reverse engineer effectively a triangle, a unique triangle around the three Giza pyramids, which point to the apex of that triangle that we reverse engineer around those three pyramids. Essentially points to a unique location to the southwest of the Giza Plateau. And that's where in 2008, I basically went out on a trip to Egypt to try and get to that location.
It
was my son. It was down to my son. You know, he just asked that innocent question, and then the light just went on. You know, and that was the epiphany.
That's what we were talking about. That's so great. Is it's one of those things that, little things that you never know, but you got to stay open-minded. You got to be looking at it. And yet again, this was something that was right in front of all of us this whole time, and it just kind of clicked. Like it's almost like it was meant to be. There's somebody else I want to talk to you about.
yep.
If we can all discuss this guy without cursing and really being too hard on the fella, I'm sure it's what I call him, the man with three first names. But, and it's just simply because I do not like the way he used to do things as far as a lot of his, I guess you could say, excavation work and things. Mm-hmm. It's Colonel Richard William Howard Vice. This is the man that is solely responsible for all the misinterpretation and the trouble that we have where Egyptology and what people refer to as alternative history, which is really not, it's more of the true form of what's going on, in my opinion. But this seems to be the man that's kind of solely responsible for the troubles there with his exploits. And even in the book, you've discussed about him gun pattering doors open and things in the Great Pyramid. You're like, I can't say what I wish, but yeah, I guess we need to talk about that guy and what has been alleged upon him and what seems to be what he had done before we go on any further, really.
Yeah, okay. Well, Colonel Vice, one of the reasons why I've included this chapter of Colonel Vice in the book is because the book, I present a theory in the book which shows that the Great Pyramids aren't 4,500 years old, as Egyptologists tell us. They aren't even 10,500 or 11,500 years old, as Baval and Hancock tell us. They're much, much older than that. I present the theory in the book which shows how these Great Pyramids are actually around about 19,000 years old. Now, that presented obviously a problem, because inside the Great Pyramid, Colonel Vice in 1837 discovered these painted, red painted markings, which Egyptologists call quarry marks. Basically, the gangs at the quarries when they were hewing out these gigantuan blocks of stone, of limestone blocks, would paint their crew names with red paint, red ochre paint onto these blocks, and then they would be carted off to be placed within the construction of the Great Pyramid. So that is the orthodox theory of how these markings came to be in these chambers inside the Great Pyramid. There's these five chambers above the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid, which had Nathaniel Davidson discovered the first one of those, I think, in about 1767, something like that. It was about 70 years before Weiss discovered the next chamber above Davison's. Now, the thing about Davison, when he discovered the first of these chambers in 1767, whenever, there was no markings, no painted markings at all. And this is the thing about the Great Pyramid, about all these early giant pyramids, there are no markings inside them whatsoever. They are completely, utterly anonymous structures, which is completely the reverse of what we find in the later pyramids. The later, we go across the demarcation line where we find the smaller, inferior pyramids that the later dynastic Egyptians built. They have pyramid text in them. They have other drawings and things inside them, as do their mastaba tombs, as do their underground tombs or rock cut tombs, have all these fantastic paintings on the walls and so forth and so on. The pyramids, the giant pyramids, the first pyramids that were built by the very ancient Egyptians, are completely devoid of all of this, for good reason, because they were not religious edifices at all. They were purely perfunctory constructions built for what I call Project Osiris, which we may touch on later. But anyway, Howard Weiss opened the next chamber above Davison's chamber, which is called Wellington's Chamber. And he found some markings in there, and then he went up, blasted his way using gunpowder up the next level. He found another hidden chamber there, which he named Nelson's Chamber. A few marks in there were found. And then above that, Lady Arbuthnot's Chamber, where he found a whole lot of painted quarry marks. And then the final chamber above Lady Arbuthnot's chamber was Campbell's Chamber, what he named Campbell's Chamber. And in there he found all sorts of markings again. Now, among these markings were the cartouche of Sufis, or that's the Greek name, or one of the Greek names for the pharaoh Khufu, whom Egyptologists tell us built the Great Pyramid. So that seems quite fortuitous that they knew that Sufis, or was alleged to have built it through the writings of Herodotus and so forth, and Manetho, that Khufu or Sufis had built this structure. And there we find a cartouche in there which belongs to Sufis. I find that fortuitous, but at the same time, Egyptologists dated Khufu or this cartouche just by knowing the king list and that they had built up, of which there's hundreds of kings missing from. But anyway, they date this Sufis Khufu cartouche to around 2500 BC, which, as you can see, presented something of a problem to me if I'm saying, well, wait a minute, these structures are actually 19,000 years old, because this marking, this cartouche, if it's in a sealed chamber, it has to be original. So I investigated the matter, and I know that the international author, best-selling author, Zechariah Sitchin, he was the first guy to suggest or even claim that Howard Weiss himself forged these markings, forced the cartouche inside these chambers. And he presented some proof in his book, I think it was The Stairway to Heaven in 1980. And but unfortunately for Sitchin, he hadn't actually seen the cartouche in Campbell's chamber himself. He'd never actually seen it personally. He'd never even seen a photograph of it. and he went off half-cocked, got it all wrong, totally muddied the waters, and his claims there were very swiftly debunked. And I think quite rightly so, because he had made a genuine mistake. It was sloppy research. He should have checked his facts better in that regard. But that aside, Sitchin still raised a number of very good points which haven't yet been reasonably explained today by Egyptologists. But anyway, I digress. What I did was, part of the thing that Sitchin presented was a letter from a guy called Walter Allen, who lived in Pittsburgh in Pennsylvania. He was researching his family origins in 1954, and he was a radio ham radio enthusiast, and in this, when he was doing his research, he was speaking to various family elders, and he spoke to them, and one of the things he discovered was that his great-grandfather, a chap called Humphreys Brewer, had actually worked with Howard Weiss in 1837 at the Great Pyramid. And one of the things that Humphreys Brewer passed down, in which Walter Allen wrote in his ham radio logbook when he was discussing this with his family, was that a couple of Weiss's assistants were painting marks inside the pyramids. They were taking red ochre paint, which was still available in 1837, this ancient paint, and they were painting their own marks inside the Great Pyramid. And Humphreys Brewer took great exception to this, complained about it to Colonel Weiss, and was promptly kicked off the site for his trouble. So there are questions about that, because the problem with the story is that when you read the official account that Howard Weiss printed or published in 1840 in his book Operations Carried Out at Giza, it's done in three volumes, there's no mention of this guy Brewer, Humphreys Brewer, anywhere in the three volumes. Now, I can understand why he wouldn't be mentioned.
Right.
Yeah, I can really get my head around that one, no problem. You know, if you're accusing a guy and his team of perpetrating a fraud inside the Great Pyramid, it's hardly likely, especially if you're just a young 19, 20-year-old civil engineer, just at the start of your career. You're a non-entity, really, as far as Colonel Weiss is concerned, and so your views count for nothing, and he's basically going to be expunged. Becomes persona non grata as far as Howard Weiss is concerned, and totally written out of his official account in his published book. So it occurred to me that, well, wait a minute, that might be the case in his published book, but his field notes must exist somewhere. His official handwritten field notes must exist somewhere. So I scurried about and researched a bit, and eventually I managed to find that they were located. His actual field notes, his handwritten field notes, were located in a small archive centre down in Aylesbury, which is just outside the north of London. And so my wife Louise and I, we went down. We drove down, it was about an 800-mile round trip. We drove down, spent a few days down there in the archive centre, photographing something in the order of 600-odd pages. You know, these are full-scap pages, double-sided. And, you know, it was a big, big job. But anyway, we managed to do it. We found his field notes, managed to photograph them, and my goodness, what we discovered in those field notes. Well, as you know, it's in the book, which basically proves that Howard Weiss, we have this eyewitness account which tells us that something dodgy was happening. Well, Howard Weiss's own notes, his own handwritten field notes, pretty much confirms that.
He pretty much, you're right. He tells on himself, meaning to.
Exactly. It's right there in his notes.
That's one of the greatest stories to me ever is that story that you uncovered right there of the whole thing. As much as I love the book and all of this, that story to me means more than anything because it lets you know that sometimes people get this romantic idea of explorers and these men and back in the day, and that they were way more, morally just and courageous and things than anything that goes on today. But that's just not true. You do find out that they are just like we were, and that money talks.
If you look at the history of Howard Vyse, you know, you go back to his early career when he was a politician. You know, I mean, that guy totally bribed his way into power, into becoming a member of parliament for the UK Parliament. He bought something like 932 votes, which contravened, you know, so many laws in the UK at that time. You know, the anti-corruption laws and during elections, and it was even brought up. You know, the one of the other contestants during that election took it to the UK Parliament to protest. And unfortunately, it wasn't, the protest wasn't upheld because they didn't have the guy, Philip Staple, who was protesting, he didn't have the evidence. But the evidence came later, I think in 1869, a number of years after Vyse's death, that, yeah, he did. He did do this. Yeah. He did buy all these votes, but the evidence only came out long after Howard Vyse's death. So this is actually touches on my new book, which is it's called Great Pyramid Hoax: The Evidence, and this is the one I've actually just sent it off to Inner Traditions Baring Co. So that'll be out probably I think December 2016, something like that. And there's a pile of evidence in the new book. There's some in the secret chamber of Osiris, but I think in the new book I've got something like 14 or 15 different pieces of evidence which point to this fraud, this hoax having occurred inside the Great Pyramid in 1837.
I was just about to say that could be a book all in itself, and then now here you go talking about it is going
to
be a book.
Yeah,
all
I can't
in
wait
itself.
To read that. I mean, it's amazing. Like Cam was saying, it's the greatest story told. It's probably the greatest story that mankind hasn't been told. I mean, the fact that we're still taught today and that Egyptologists are clinging onto this idea that the Great Pyramids are only 4,000 years old, despite all the things that Mr. Vyse did, despite all this evidence that shows that they're far older. I mean, there's other structures on the Giza Plateau that you can tell were built on an ancient structure prior to that.
Yeah.
And there's so many things, and you outline them even in your book, about the differences in the shape of the pyramids. Mm-hmm. The three major ones, G1, 2, and 3, compared to the other mastaba tombs, and how the architecture was different. Why were these square when all the other architecture in the area is like rectangular? You outline in there not just the shape, but the size of the things, and also like the security. That's one of my favorite parts. Mm-hmm. These things were not a tomb. And if they were a tomb, why would they go through all these efforts to make it, to like show you how to get access inside the pyramids? Not only that, there's other things outside that is almost like schematics, right? Like trail passageways, schematics, a map, like exactly showing you how to gain access to these tombs. Yet we hold on to this idea that that's what they were, that they were tombs. And if they were not tombs, what is it, Scott, that you can tell the people that you think that these great pyramids really were?
Well, they're definitely not tombs, although I think, to be fair to Egyptologists and to the historians that tell us they were, is that I think, as I said, I talk about this demarcation line, this historical demarcation line. The early giant pyramids definitely were not tombs, but I think the later, smaller, inferior pyramids perhaps were built as tombs. And I think this is why we are receiving mixed messages from some of the earliest historians. Like the ancient texts that have come down to us, the Arabic texts tell us that the pyramids, something happened in ancient Egypt thousands and thousands of years ago. The stars in the sky suddenly, without warning, moved away from their normal course. Yeah, so the king, Saurid, he asked his astronomer priest, what does this mean? And the astronomer priest basically said, well, in 300 years, there's going to be a massive deluge which will drown the entire kingdom. And after that, there'll be a conflagration, a fire, a drought, a severe drought. And so the king, when he heard this, said, right, okay, what we're going to do is to build pyramids. And inside these pyramids, we're going to store everything that the civilization or kingdom or country will need to restart, to reboot our civilization. And so inside these structures, they would put everything like, you know, grain, barley, wheat, all sorts of seed types. They would put tools, they would put civilizing knowledge on the inside and the outside, you know, all manner of things they would put inside these structures in order for the kingdom to reboot itself. Now, this isn't me just, you know, speculating this. This is one of the purposes of the pyramids that has actually been passed down to us, but it's one that is largely ignored by the Egyptologists, because they just see the pyramids of Egypt as one continuous stream, one continuous legacy of, you know, well, if these later ones were built as tombs, then the ones further back, you know, the back project what they know about the much, much later culture and much, much later civilization, the back project that onto a much, much earlier civilization of which they know virtually nothing about. And this is what's going on, you know, but these later ones, and the dynastic period pyramids, as I call them, they would have been built when the pyramids basically became a religion. You know, when the first pyramids were built to store grain and all these different seed types and tools and all sorts of other things. You know, this saved the kingdom. This allowed the kingdom to be reborn. This is why, you know, the Benben stone, I don't know if you're familiar with the Benben stone, it's basically what the apex or the capstone of the pyramid. And symbolically, it is associated with the Bennu bird in Egypt, which has the similar properties to the phoenix, whereby it can rise from the ashes of its own destruction. And this is, you know, totally encapsulated in the symbology of the pyramid. That's what they were about. They were about the rebirth of the kingdom, not the rebirth of the king. That came later when the whole concept had become a religion much, much later in ancient Egyptian civilization. And that is when, you know, the Osiris religion rose, because these first pyramids were Osiris. You know, the body of Osiris, quite literally 16 parts of it lying across the land of Egypt, filled with grain. And what we find later, the later culture of ancient Egypt doing, we find them creating what are called corn mummies during the festival, or the Osiris festival of Kuak. And inside these corn mummies, these were effigies of Osiris, the god Osiris. And inside these, they would place grain inside these corn mummies and would bury them in the ground. You know, so this, what you have is a corn mummy of Osiris filled with grain. And that's essentially, you know, mirroring reflecting what the pyramids were. The first 16 pyramids were the body of Osiris filled with grain. It's just taking that idea and just, you know, celebrating it, commemorating it in a ritualistic form in the much later dynasties. And what they would also, another part of this festival of Kuak is they would have these small rectangular boxes, some made of stone, some made of wood, and they would only be about 20 inches long by maybe about 5 or 6 inches wide. And these would be filled with earth, and they would sprinkle grain on top of the earth. This symbolized, this was a Chthonic ritual. It symbolized the rebirth of the earth, and that's what the first pyramids were all about. It's about the rebirth of the earth, the kingdom, not the king, that would come later. This is what it was. They believed their kingdom was in peril, and that's why they built these first 16 pyramids. Now, this box of earth, they would, these small boxes, we call them Osiris bricks, and what they would do is they would bury them in the ground and they'd place a large rock on top of it, symbolizing the primeval mound. This is a primeval mound that apparently rose out of the floodwaters of the creation and became the first land above the floodwaters. And out of this primeval mound, this pyramid, everything in creation came out of it and, you know, basically created the world and everything else. So this is the mythology, this is the symbology, and this is what I try to do in the book, is to try to connect all these dots, these different stories, the pyramid text, the myth of Osiris, the pyramids, the grain, the Osiris beds, Osiris bricks. You know, I try to, the corn mummies, I try to create, you know, a cohesive narrative for all of this stuff. And that I is what I hope to do. And I think it makes sense to me. When you look inside the second pyramid, for example, at Giza, Giovanni Belzoni in 1818, he was the first modern explorer to get into that pyramid. And inside the main chamber of that, I don't call it a burial chamber, I call it the main chamber of that pyramid, he found the stone box, what Egyptologists call sarcophagus. I actually call it nebank, because the ancient Egyptians had two different words. They had a word for a stone box and they had another word for a stone box, which kind of doesn't make sense, but it does in my theory, because these stone boxes weren't sarcophagi at all. They were nebank. They were boxes filled with earth, because this was a Chthonic ritual about the rebirth of the earth. And inside that pyramid, when Belzoni opened the stone box in the pyramid of Khafre in 1818, he found it filled with earth. You know, So Egyptologists, they say, oh, well, how can we explain this one? You know, and they make up all sorts of silly stuff. Oh, well, you know, the king's body gets stolen and they decided to fill it with, go to really, really extensive trouble to fill it all with earth. You know, I'm saying, no, the best way to explain this is that it's actually all part of the same thing. You know, the small boxes that they were burying of earth that they were burying in later dynasties, you know, these are basically replicating the you know, the earlier tradition, you know, what these pyramids were all about. This stone box in, filled with earth in G2 was the archetype nebank, which the later cultures were basically celebrating in this ritual, this festival of Kuak. You know, so all points to the fact that these pyramids were built as a, what I call a Project Osiris. It was a national recovery system they were building, a bit like what we have done ourselves today with, you know, the Svalbard Global Seed Vault up in the Arctic Circle, mm-hmm. which opened, I think, in 2008. We have placed every conceivable seed anywhere in the world, from everywhere in the world, inside that vault. And we did that in case anything, you know, any major disaster occurs to the earth, so that we can reseed the planet should something major happen. The ancient Egyptians believed their kingdom, you know, there was going to be a great deluge that was going to wipe their civilization clean off the face of the earth. And they built these structures to withstand. They built them, and they built them so high that you could see them from like, you know, 50, 60, 70 miles away, so they could be easily found. You're not going to build these vaults, these recovery vaults, these chambers into a natural mountain. You're not going to do that, because we'd be build them deep into a natural mountain. How are you going to find them?
Right. They wanted them to stand out.
Yeah, you need them to stand out in the natural environment as unnatural mountains or man-made mountains. They stand out in the natural environment. They're easy to find. They needed to be easy to find, because they needed to, you know, get these chambers open and get you know, that their kingdom receded, you know, in good time to basically, well, you know, have their civilization rebooted again, you know. So that's what they needed to do. That's why they built them so strong to withstand the deluge. That's why they built them so high so that they could be discovered easily. But these are exactly the, you know, is that what you're going to do for a king? You're going to build a massive structure that can be seen by every tomb raider in the land from 70 miles away? No, you're absolutely not going to do that.
And not to mention the fact that there was nothing inside of them to as much as the later Egyptian kings would mark up everything with their likenesses. There was really nothing inside there to base anything on. And I like how even in the book you discuss, I believe it's the inventory steal or whatnot, the book, the writings that the Egyptians had that discuss the upkeep that they themselves did on the existing pyramids.
Yeah, that's right. You know, the ancient Egyptians tell us themselves that their civilization is, I think, something like 40,000 years old. That's what they tell us. I'm not just saying the pyramids are 19,000 years old. The ancient Egyptians themselves tell us their civilization is around 40,000 years old. You know, so if you've got these structures by the time of the early dynastic period, where Khufu's around and Khafre's around, you know, these guys are basically repairing structures that are already ancient in their time. You know, so this is why you find on the inventory stela, Khufu is making all sorts of repairs at Giza. You know, so this, you know, again, the Egyptologists, they dismiss the inventory stela because it doesn't fit their narrative. You know, that oh no, these structures, this can't be right. You know, these structures are only, you know, 4,500 years old. They were built in the time of Khufu, but you know the evidence is there that, you know, it's just wrong. And yeah, they do all these radiocarbon dating tests. I think two studies have been made of the early pyramids. And they've dated them to various dates. Roughly, I think the oldest carbon date they got was about 3,200 BC from the Great Pyramid. But, you know, even Dr. Hawass doesn't trust carbon dating. He's gone on record as saying, you know, it's useless. You know, it just doesn't help. He's gone on record as saying radiocarbon dating will never help archaeology and, you know, I think he said 5,000 years, it'll never help archaeology. It's useless. In archaeology, we call radiocarbon dating imaginary dates. That's what Dr. Hawass himself said about radiocarbon dating. And he's a guy that should know because he's probably sent more artifacts to labs across the world to be radiocarbon dated than anyone alive. And, you know, he's probably got the dates back from the radiocarbon labs and they just do not match the archaeological dating that they can do. You know, so, you know, he's a guy that would know if radiocarbon dating works. And there's all sorts of problems with radiocarbon dating, but, you know, I mean, we could spend a whole show and then some, you know, just discussing that topic alone. But, you know, this basically is, you know, my position is I believe the structures are 19,000 years old. They were built by the very ancient Egyptians, and you know the dynastic Egyptians basically inherited them. By this time, you know, the pyramids had, you know, the whole concept, the creation story that the pyramids were about, you know, this is what created the ancient Egyptians creation story about the pyramid rising out of the floodwaters, you know, in Khufu's time, because that's literally what they believed. You know, that's the reason why they were built. And so they believed that, you know, and so, you know, Khufu and Khafre and Menkaure, they're essentially repairing these structures, as was Snefru. You know, Snefru, if you look at the pyramid of Meidum, you know, that's a really unusual pyramid because, you know, the original builders who built it on solid bedrock. the core of that pyramid, which the core of it is actually a step pyramid. And then apparently Snefru converted it into a true pyramid with, you know, perfectly smooth sides. But the thing is, Snefru was Khufu's father, who built actually four pyramids. Now, why do you need four pyramids if you've only got, for burial, if you've only got one body? You know, so there's all these contradictions in you know, the mainstream view of these structures, which just does not explain. But if you're a builder, you know, and you're wanting to build as many recovery vaults as you can in 300 years, then that explains why one guy could build 3, 4, 5, 10 of these structures. But anyway, we have Snefru building this core pyramid, the step, or rather converting this step pyramid, what was a step pyramid, built in solid bedrock. But Snefru, who hasn't a clue how to build a pyramid, builds his conversion on sand, you know, and it collapses shortly after, you know, he completes it, you know. So that shows you right there that we have two completely different builders, sets of builders, people from a much more ancient time that knew what they were doing, and then that knowledge got lost after this cataclysm. It got lost, and, you know, the Egyptian civilization essentially went into a dark age, if you like, and the knowledge was lost. And by the time, you know, Khufu and Snefru and the fourth dynasty, so forth, they were basically trying to repair these already ancient structures and probably not making too great a job of it.
Well, everything that you have found, it points to... It's not just what you found to point to that date, but there's a lot of other people seem to have found things that, and especially with the finding of Göbekli Tepe and then whatever they're going to uncover at Göyüng Padang, there's no telling what, but it seems like it does point back to exactly what you're saying, is a much, much older civilization. Now, I got to ask you one other thing before we wrap this puppy up. There's something that, it sounds to me like we're talking to an Egyptian person of Egyptian heritage themselves from Scotland, because it sounds like there is a tie there from what you were saying, and I've heard it from other people. Can you explain that so people don't think I'm just going crazy saying these words?
When I went out to Egypt, I was trying to get to this secret chamber. This is the 17th part of Osiris's body. You know, there's all these parts of Osiris's body which his wife Isis was searching for, and she found all of them except one part. And this part, I believe, is the part which holds, you know, was part of the recovery system, the Project Osiris, which they had to hide this part. It couldn't be one of the giant pyramids, which are easily seen and easily found. This part, which is pointed to by the centroidic geometry, is hidden away to the southwest of the Giza Plateau, and it probably contains all of the high wisdom, the high knowledge of this very ancient Egyptian civilization, which I believe genuinely existed. Now, when I tried to get to that location that I had identified, I was walking through the Giza Plateau heading in the southwest direction, and then eventually my path was blocked by this, it's called Hawass's Wall, and basically it's a 13-foot wire fence. Some of it's wire, some of it's actually a physical brick wall. And there's all these guard turrets and so forth and so on, you can see dotted around. And the spot that I wanted to get to, the apex of this centroid triangle, which I'd mapped over the three great Giza pyramids, was just about 200 yards away, just over the crest of a hill. But I had to get over this fence, and I tried climbing it. And I heard this almighty noise behind me, and it was a camel. And on top of the camel was one of the antiquities guards. And he was just shaking his head. What are you doing? And so I basically got myself down off the fence. He asked, where are you from? He says, American. I went, no. I shook my head, went, no. Scottish, I'm from Scotland. And I said, and I just thought about that for a moment. He says, from Scotland? You're Egyptian, brother. Because there's this ancient legend that they're still taught in Egypt to this day, that the daughter of the Pharaoh Akhenaten, Princess Meretis, or Skota, as she's also known, discovered Skota or Scotland, thousands of years ago. And this is what they're taught in Egypt. And funnily enough, in some places in Scotland, we're also taught that. And there's a very good book by Egyptologist, a badge-carrying Egyptologist, Lorraine Evans, called Kingdom of the Ark. And she explores that idea as well. It's a very good book which explores the ancient links between Egypt, Ireland, and Scotland. So, yeah, because of that connection, I just got a slight rebuke from the guard and told to be on my way. But otherwise, I think I might have been facing a slightly more daunting prospect.
I like how he instantly blames us, blames Americans. He's like, oh, so you're American. You're like, no, I'm Scottish.
Right. He did. You say, well, I can only imagine, guys. I can only imagine that that is because there's more American visitors to Giza than probably any other nationality.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah. So, but yeah, that kind of got me out of that scrape. So I was very thankful for my Scottish Egyptian heritage.
I love that. I hopefully one day we'll get you, and now that you've finally turned in the other book and it'll be ready, jump into that. I would love, that is a story all in itself, because we've heard both ways. We've heard that where the Egyptians found Scotland, and we've heard where the Scottish are actually the first Egyptians. So we've heard some different lines coming from different people. So I hopefully somebody will pick it up and run with that one.
Yeah. I mean, even in Scotland today, we call the top of a mountain, or the peak or the apex of a mountain, we call it a ben, as in like Ben Nevis, Ben Lomond. You may have heard of these. Mm-hmm. And that's what the ancient Egyptians called the top of a pyramid, a ben.
If you start looking at the phonetic right, the lineage there of different terms and some of the language, there's going to be some ties. There's going to be something that links them together pretty hard.
The ancient Egyptians were the first to wear the kilt and play bagpipes. There you go.
Nice.
Well, thank you so much for coming on today, Scott. What an amazing book. Do you have a website or anything you'd like to plug?
Just really my own website, guys. There's a lot of information on there, a lot of photographs, a lot of articles, a lot of presentations. I have a couple more that I'll be uploading in the next week or so. That's www.scottcrichton, that's all the one word, .co.uk.
Awesome.
That'll be perfect. And when your other book comes out, we're definitely going to have you come on and talk about Vice and everybody some more.
Well, I would love to. Absolutely.
Thanks a lot, Scott.
Cheers, guys. It's been a pleasure speaking to you.
And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. Interesting interview. I love Scott Crichton. I love his book. I love his idea. It's crazy to me that, you know, it's been right there staring us in the face, but just nobody ever noticed it before. A lot of the things is, you know, like you were talking about before we got into the interview, is how, you know, we were always taught that the Great Pyramids were giant tombs mm-hmm. for the pharaohs. Mm-hmm. But there's not really any significant evidence that shows that.
No.
And, you know, what Scott suggests is that these 16 pyramids of ancient Egypt were not these royal tombs, but in fact were indestructible recovery vaults designed to revive a civilization after an anticipated catastrophe, mm-hmm. which they called the Deluge of Thoth.
Thoth, yeah.
Which they knew there was a great flood coming. They built these vaults. They stored things in it, different ones, different things, grain, seeds, you know, mm-hmm. like seed banks, books on knowledge, so that, and it would be clear, because, you know, they found other pharaohs' tombs in ancient Egypt,
that you can tell that they didn't want people to find them. So they, you know, they had all kinds of safeguards to protect grave robbers and thieves. But that's not the way these pyramids are. The pyramids stand out. I mean, if you're looking across the Nile Valley, they stand out for miles.
Yeah.
And they're purposely set up to let people in. It's because they wanted to help out civilization. It's a really good thought. It's like a time capsule.
Mm-hmm.
We always talk about it. When you're in school, a lot of kids, as a class, you'll bury a time capsule. And then I remember digging up a time capsule that was buried like in the 60s. And it was really cool. But this is a way, you know, we have a seed bank. I think it's in Sweden or Switzerland mm-hmm. or something. I mean, but this is a thing. You know, and this is what the end of the world, everybody's always prophesizing, you know. If astronomers or something had seen a giant asteroid coming towards the Earth, and they know there was nothing we could do, I believe that we would do something similar.
Try to
say,
anyway.
Look, yeah. A lot of humanity is about to be wiped out. It's at least put together some kind of safeguard, something for if anyone is able to survive the catastrophe, they could rebuild their civilization. And I think that's exactly what happened here.
Well, what's funny is you and I have discussed this, not that we came up with what he come up with and all that, but you and I have kicked around probably 10 years ago. What if it was a time capsule? You know, like what if there was stuff stored in it and it just got taken out, like looted over time? And then I remember we never thought much about it because we got into more and more of the ancient history and really went to studying and looking at it being built much, much older. And then the stuff that Scott brings out, I'm like, he's right. That dude, it just feels right. It just
it feels right.
Right. Yeah, it does. It just, you're kind of like, man, he makes a lot of sense. A lot of sense with the stuff that he talks about. The book, also the secret chamber. That's another thing that I wish you can't get to. I mean, it really does seem, I mean, it's there. You just can't get to it.
That's
it's,
yep.
There's so much more. I hope Scott continues and keeps going. And like we said, he's going to be discussing and doing another book on Mr. Vice. And that'll be a good one. You'll get to see what kind of debauchery really went on during the study of early studies of Egyptology. Yeah. So, and I had a great time. It was awesome.
It's a fantastic book. I suggest anyone pick it up. I'll put show notes and links to it in the show notes. It's The Secret Chamber of Osiris, Lost Knowledge of the 16 Pyramids. The author is once again Scott Crichton. Fantastic book, especially if you're into that type of thing. Cam, what else we got going on, man?
Just busy. I don't know, man. I would love to be able to tell everybody what I'm doing on the Elite Show, but I'm not even sure just
it's top
yet.
Secret.
That's right.
It's top secret. You have to sign up to find out.
Congrats to the U.S. women's soccer team.
Yes, World
that
Cup
was,
champions.
That was a really good. And congrats is a must to all of our Irish fans for Mr. Conor McGregor.
Great fight.
Winning the interim title this
great
weekend.
Fight.
Amazing fight. The card was amazing.
My hat's off to Chad Mendes, though, for taking that fight on such short
notice. 2 weeks'
notice. You know what I mean? He
two
didn't
weeks
have a full
notice.
Training camp, so that might have affected the outcome.
It may have. It's a great fight. A big round of applause also, too, for Rory McDonald and Robbie Lawler. A war. Folks, even if you're not into MMA, if you want to look and try to catch a clip of that fight, it's brutal. These two men went to war.
Yeah.
So my hat's off to everybody who participated in that. Hope everybody's having a great day. For all you listeners, I hope y'all have a wonderful week. I hope you don't work too hard. Don't nobody get too cold. Don't nobody get too hot. If you're into more thylacine stuff, too, our buddies down in Australia, Waz and Chris, they're starting a podcast, and they actually have The True, the TRU. If you go to their website, you can actually look, but it's on YouTube right now. But they've got, I think, 3 or 4 episodes up
yep.
of the podcast. You can go and you can listen to what they've been up to and the research that they've been doing and all that stuff, which is really fun. I mean, I'm down for everybody to have a podcast. It's fun.
Yeah, and I mean, and just like we've mentioned before, you can go on their website and you can actually donate to those game cameras and
mm-hmm.
help out the team. That's
mm-hmm.
really cool if you want to become a cryptozoologist. There's your chance. You can help support them in the search for this thing.
That's right.
Pretty interesting stuff. Don't forget, folks, if you have stories of your own or things you'd like to share, you can always email the show, expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. You can call the show. You can leave us a message about why you like Expanded Perspectives. You can leave a message why others should join. You can leave messages of your own experiences if you prefer to call in rather than type it out.
Right.
Nobody likes typing, especially if you're a single-finger typer.
That's me.
You just peck away one finger at a time. You can call the show, Cam. That number's 817-945-3828. Is there anything else? You can follow the show, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. You know the deal.
Yeah.
We're pretty easy to find.
Yeah, we're real easy to find. We're going to be periscoping again like we always talk about. And if you follow on Instagram, we try to post the books a week or so before we do the before we release the interviews. We have pictures of the books that come out, stuff like that. So, yep.
And if you like Expanded Perspectives, don't forget, if you're not an Elite member, you can join now. You can go to the website, expandedperspectives.com. There's something like 48, 49 episodes back there that you have not listened to unless you're an Elite member. Mm-hmm. It's a complete back catalog, and you can get access to all of it for $5. So
that's right.
You're paying like 10 cents an episode. So that's it, folks. Have a good week. Be careful. We'll talk to you next time. For those elitists, we'll speak to you Thursday. Peace.